Hi, this is Sedge Thompson. Welcome to this special audio highlights podcast from West Coast Live. For more information about our shows and other guests and podcasts, wcl.org. My next guest on West Coast Live is a naturalist. Did you have her theme ready to go?
Yeah.
Okay, there we are. Thank you. She's a naturalist at the Point Reyes Bird Observatory Conservation Science. And she's a storyteller, an improv artist on her own, and I've known her for 34 years, I think. And we've been out exploring the Duxbury Reef from time to time together and looking for mushrooms. Will you please welcome Claire Peasley to West Coast Live?
You know, Sedge, our problem was looking for those mushrooms in Duxbury Reef. We're just going to have to keep going back again and again, I suggest, on the next...
No, there were two different trips.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Duxbury Reef doesn't have very many mushrooms.
It has a lot of mussels and rock crabs and anemones and things. Yeah.
Nudibranchs.
Yes, on occasion. The lucky times.
So first of all, but before we get into your report and your thoughts on the snowy owl, I'd like to talk about an extraordinary birder who died this past week in his nearly 68. But I've certainly went out with him on a couple of field trips in the 80s and 90s. You introduced me to him. A roommate knew him well, I think from the time they were boys or teenagers, following birds and learning about birds. And he was described as kind of a shaman and a guru. He was the co-founder of the Point Reyes Bird Observatory. His name is Rich Stalkup. And he inspired many people to look at the world of nature in a very different way. And you knew him well.
Yeah, and we're all feeling the loss in a big way. He actually died on the evening we were gathered together at the Dance Palace in Point Reyes Station for the compilation dinner for the annual Christmas bird count out over Point Reyes. And Rich actually started that bird count with a couple other good friends, something like 42 or 43 years ago. And this was the first one he'd ever missed. So we were sending him good wishes, not knowing that probably at that very moment his soul was flying out over the ocean with all the fulmars and albatross and shearwaters that he studied and loved so much.
He led thousands of tours. He introduced people to this passion of his, and it was more than birds. He was a herpetologist, and he knew about dragonflies, and he had kind of a wisdom about the natural world.
He is a true naturalist, and this is a good thing to know about and be inspired by. And his lifespan, almost 68 years, born in 1944, and a spark, a catalyst, and a major force for inspiring people to love birds and go into nature and be with the critters and the places that we love, was really coincident with the rise of our present day environmental awareness and activism and this whole explosion of birding interest in the second half of the 20th century. And there are literally thousands of people whose lives Rich touched, and generations of folks. He was really keen on mentoring young people who are now, young adults and are teaching children younger than themselves, because he saw that love of the natural world, connecting with it personally, as the key to protecting it. So he had a real sense of pride in the work of PRBO Conservation Science, and like the field trips that you may have attended, he promoted PRBO, and he also taught the Beach Watch volunteers for the Gulf of the Farallones National Marine Sanctuary Association. They go out and monitor what's going on with living and not living organisms off the coast, and he had his own birding groups, and he led our birdathon for the last few years. We named the PRBO Birdathon after Rich this year, he would take children out. He had maybe 7 or 8 different birdathon days, that these 24-hour marathons that he would go out and help people find big lists of more birds than they even knew were existed in the area, and he would make sure everybody saw everything and appreciated everything. And if it was something common but beautiful, people would say, well, we've already seen a Western bluebird. And Rich would answer, we haven't seen that Western bluebird. And he had children. He had a team called the Drake's Bay Sanderlings, which are children of all ages that would gang up and meet him with a Coleman lantern before dawn on a picnic table in one of the birdie places in the Point Reyes seashore, and then they'd strike out into the forest trying to find owls. These are his people. We are his tribe of his, you know, his legacy.
I read that he was one of the first birders to go out to the Farallon Islands.
Well, one of the things that drew Rich as a teenager and some of his hotshot buddies in the 60s out to Point Reyes, the outer Point Reyes, and then ultimately to the Farallons, was this phenomenon of these rare birds that were showing up. And they were learning how to identify them and secure an identification in the scientific record without having to shoot the thing, which was how natural history worked and still does to some degree. You have these museum collections, which are invaluable.
Charles Darwin had a shootist who went along with him.
Sure, and so did John James Audubon, a shotgun. But the collections you can't do without. They have so much information in them, including now genetic information. But at the time, in the 60s and early 70s, these kids wanted to know what was there and when. So they made an effort to really seriously collect data. And they actually, the forerunner of the Point Reyes Bird Observatory was a little sheep herder's shed on a ranch on the outer point where they would ride their bikes around and set up mist nets here and there, but they would census the whole outer point and collect all these records on these strange birds from the East Coast that were showing up there in migration. And they said, well, if this is happening on the outer coast, what about those lumps of rock sitting out there on the horizon? That must be amazing. Yeah, and so one of the very first trips out there was coincided with one of these land bird waves during migration, warblers and vireos and flycatchers and orioles and tanagers from the other flyway. And so it's been kind of exciting to decode that. But that was the original reason for a bird observatory at Point Reyes, and then it kind of grew and expanded from there to this day, like 48 years later.
There was a way that he would have people who were in the field with him try to imagine themselves as the creature they were seeking to see. And he would say, what would be good for the bird here? Why would a bird want to come to this place? What, you know, what's going on? And kind of help people put themselves in the place of another species.
He was a fantastic teacher and raconteur and writer, and we've got a lot of his writing on record. And you can find his whole collection of focus articles on bird identification on the prbo.org website, along with lots of other info about Rich and links. But yeah, he would connect you with in your heart and your mind with the critter. And that was his way of understanding the world, and also a very generous way of teaching, because you can't be wrong. You can guess at something, and that's a good guess, and then eventually, you know, we home in on what's really understood about this.
Was there some technique or style or way of being in the world that you learned from him, a way of being observant, alert to the possibility of an unusual bird or an ordinary bird being nearby?
You know, I wish I could say I soaked up just a tiny dose of his magic. That whole business of empathizing with the critter and saying, well, why is it here? What's good for it? What's good for it in this spot? He was renowned for being in the right place at the right time, as if the birds and salamanders and dragonflies and what have you came to him. And even in groups of birders and field ornithologists who were perhaps as skilled at identifying things, you know, sometimes the stories go, Rich would show up and get out of the car and say, oh, there's the gray catbird over there. And they'd all been standing in the parking lot shooting the breeze after a whole day of looking for this bird. Or he'd you know, gather himself under a tree and do his little pishing thing, you know, psh, 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 psh. to attract the birds. And it was almost as if they were there waiting for him, and all these special rarities would show up all around him. What I've learned from him really is just that loving, smiling grace. He had a tremendous sense of humor, and we could share nature laughter together, which is my fave.
Yeah. When I saw pictures of him from the 60s and 70s, shortly before I had a couple of walks with him, is that he was a hippie.
He was a wild man back then. Oh, my God. He always lived out on the edge, you know, on the edge of the Gulf of the Farallones, the edge of what was known about certain habitats, racing around California to do a big year from the desert to the mountains to the Great Basin to the coast and halfway out to the Cordill Banks and back. Yeah.
What a life.
He burned hard and bright, and he partied with the Grateful Dead, and there are all these myths and legends, and he was, you know, we teased him about being a legend in his own time. We gave him a T-shirt that said that one time. But he was a regular guy, you know. He's a marvelous family man, a great, great, steady colleague. We sat next to each other. I hope that his little cubicle at PRBO is going to become like a permanent shrine. One of his last little memos to himself was what he's going to write in the next Observer that I edit, right, his next focus piece. Instead, we're going to devote the whole issue to him. And we're going to commemorate Rich in great and happy and celebrated ways. And if people want to find out more about an event in late January, you can go to our website. It's a, you know, RSVP kind of thing, but people would be welcome. And he's a solid, steady, warm presence that, I can't tell you how much we miss him.
Rich Stalkup.
Yep.
And the Snowy Owl. Have you been looking at snowy owls?
Yeah, I was up in Seattle last week, and I was sort of anticipating the solstice, and this is a bird that is perfect for the winter solstice. And so I sort of, like, in the spirit of Rich Stalkup, I went out on a quest to find one of the individuals that has shown up in the Pacific Northwest in this kind of a rare occasion. The one I was looking for, however, was not out in some, like, distant coastal estuary dune system. It was in downtown Seattle, in a neighborhood justly called the Sunset View District, looking out over Puget Sound and out towards the Olympics. And I had a great winter day. It was steely white. There's that low, low northerly light. And there was a hailstorm. I was looking for a hail bow, actually, because the sun was shining.
A hail bow?
Have you ever seen a hail bow? A couple of us went running.
I've seen a snow bow.
Well, there you go. There must be such a thing as a hail bow. I think I came close. And a couple of us ran across the street here in Mill Valley just 10 minutes ago because it was raining and sunshining, but there it wasn't quite right for a rainbow. But it was blistery cold. Blustery cold? Blistery cold. It was.
I've never heard blistery and cold in the same. Usually, it's like blisteringly hot or something.
Yeah, I like blistery cold though. That's almost how my fingertips felt, and so I made my way over to the Sunset neighborhood, and there were like coordinates from the Washington State has an ornithological society, and their listserv for rare bird sightings, like California has one too. It's loaded up with memories of Rich right now, along with all the rare birds that people are finding around here. The one in Washington State is called the Tweeters. And this is long before Twitter. They put up the tweets about, like, a strange tanager or flycatcher or rarity that shows up there. And there are quite a few Tweeter notices about snowy owls over in this neighborhood at different intersections, and I could go either to 74th and 31st or 75th and 35th, and so I sort of parked in the middle of all this, and I walked the streets feeling like, you know, blustery and blistery and bold, and I'd seen photos and videos of these little stubby white beings that would, like, perch during the day, often next to a chimney, like that was warm, and they'd kind of, like, be leaning up against it, and they'd, like, be stock still, like little white statues. They're very stout and sleek. They're a heavy owl, like 4, 5, sometimes 6 pounds, the big females. And they're very smooth and have very white, dense feathers with black barring. They look like little overstuffed pillows, right? And then the yellow eyes with the black rims, and their little black beak is totally surrounded by these white bristles that help them sense things. And so they look like a little vertical black slash in the middle of their face. And so here's this little being turning his head like 270 degrees from one side to the other and like staring. You don't want to be a squirrel or a kitten or a Norway rat in that neighborhood because these guys are hungry.
So would people really like to have a snowy owl around rather than a house cat, for instance, if they were allergic to cats for getting the rats and the mice?
I would, definitely. And the last time snowy owls were this far south was, well, there were some up in the Delta. There was one that showed up in the Sacramento Delta area, Solano County, in like 2006 and again in 2007. But the last time there was a really big eruption, that's IRR-uption, of like southbound overflow, usually young male snowy owls, was back in 1974, and there were some in the Bay Area and one, a few maybe as far south as Monterey County. But these have only like slid down in on the West Coast into the Pacific Northwest. They commonly winter throughout the Northern Great Plains, and there's this big, huge gap between their wintering grounds and their far north tundra breeding grounds.
You use the word eruption, IR. Is that a burning term?
Well, it's a biological thing. When there's a sort of a overdose of productivity, perhaps, on one end of the seasonal spectrum, and a shortage of food in the winter season, or it could be seeds if we're talking about finches, or it could be lemmings if we're talking about snowy owls. Some of the younger, less dominant ones get pushed out. And in this species, like so many raptors, the female is much larger. So the big, hunky, snowy owl females lay down winter territories, and then the adult males probably get something around the edges of that. And the juveniles, especially the juvenile males, which are kind of, I don't know, shrimpy and wimpy, get pushed out. And so they have to go further south. These are truly northern nomads. They spread out wherever the food is good, even during breeding season. And so they're set to go wandering. They're really not set for a rooftop in the sunset.
So why were they there? Why were they in a suburb of Seattle?
They show up in places where they shouldn't necessarily be. I mean, the better habitat for them would be out on ocean shores by Gray's Harbor on the coast of Washington, perched on a driftwood log. That's where I actually saw my first one.
Much more kind of romantic setting.
And it feels a little bit more like tundra than a rooftop also. But they can fly after prey. They can catch things on the wing. They like to stand on a perch and swivel their head and look for something and beam in on it with their asynchronous ears and their extra good eyesight and swoop down to grab it. If they're hungry, it's said that they'll down 3 or 4 lemmings head first before they slow down and start to pick them apart and like look at their food. They can also...
Wow, that's 3 lemmings head first, just like that.
Oh, they take care of a lot of surplus lemming on the tundra.
Anywhere near a cliff, fiscal or otherwise? You know?
Yeah, they are the cliff. And I mean, they have up to 11 chicks that hatch asynchronously and come out like from very large to very small and are dependent on their parents for like 5 weeks after they walk off the nest, which is just on a tussock, right? And it's said that a brood of 9 chicks can like down 1,700 pounds of lemmings in those 5 weeks or something like this. But lemmings are patchy and mosaic-like, and so is the distribution of the snowy owls. It's, you know, there's some connection with the 4-year population swing in the lemming population that sends these owls south, but that's not the only factor. When they get really creative and hungry, they can go after birds, including water birds. They can fly out and snag water birds right off the surface.
They'll go after other birds.
Oh, yeah. including grebes and auklets and things that are swimming. They'll wade into the water and grab crabs with their feet. They don't get mushrooms out of the intertidal, but they do get crabs.
The snowy owl, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Rich Stahlkopf. Thank you, West Coast Live.
Thank you, PRBO, PRBO Conservation Science, and Claire Peasley.
My pleasure.
Okay.
Happy solstice.
Happy solstice. This is Edge Thompson. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Try out others from West Coast Live right here, and we look forward to having you in one of our audiences one day. For more information, wcl.org.